Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. Today is episode 170 with the title, Turning Rejections into Opportunities. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome C. Guz. C. is a female entrepreneur and job seeker who has turned her own experiences with rejection into a mission to humanise recruitment and make the hiring process more inclusive for all. And when I asked C to describe her superpower, she said, it is transforming setbacks into empowerment by advocating for inclusive recruitment practices that allow everyone to thrive. Hello, C. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Joanne. It's so nice to be here and so nice to be doing this with you.
I'm glad I actually pushed record on this episode because we were chatting away. We were wasting all this fabulous material. So brilliant. So yeah, we've got loads of stuff for our guests to listen to today. So you see, you said when we were chatting away, you're in Turkey, is that right? Whereabouts in Turkey? Whereabouts in, I don't know it that well. I know Bodrum probably, is probably about it.
Currently in Istanbul, commonly known as, you know, the Constantinople, the city with two coasts. So that's where I was born and raised then.
Wow, because Turkey is a interesting country because it's a bit Mediterranean, it's almost a bit African, it's almost a bit Asian, almost a bit European. It's kind of on that really sort of strange gateway zone, isn't it?
I'd say so, but I personally never found my belonging here, and that's also, you know, what eventually led me to, you know, seeking these global doors and opportunities.
So you know, like me, actually, you know, you faced rejections in your job search, and so how did you turn those kind of rejections and channel those into kind of an entrepreneurial spirit? You know, how do you humanize recruitment?
Absolutely, that's a great question. Thank you so much. Accidentally, I think I've been studying the whole space for the last 8 years, and I like initially didn't really mean to. Like, I was a very young person, young professional, looking to like get opportunities, get the right mentorship, and then the last 5 years for me has been really difficult because I got more than 13,000 rejections. And that meant like slap on the wrist, a kick on the face. But that eventually made me navigate a 10-month of unemployment period where the financial insecurity was at an all-time low, at an all-time high. And essentially, I looked at everything that I was navigating and how degraded, you know, unqualified I felt. And it felt like as if I am totally useless, as if I cannot achieve nothing. And the job market was really like, you know, transforming when I was an undergraduate. And then when I graduated, it just became a whole chaos with the layoffs and the economic inflations and everything. So in that 10 months, what I realized is, you know what, see, I said to myself, millions of people are going through the same thing today, and you see a solution. If you do not act on this solution, then you're not responsible. You're not fulfilling your responsibility, and you're, you know, you are not doing what it needs to be done. And if you don't do it, then no one will do it. And can you really live with yourself, you know, after 5-10 years that the solution does not exist and these people are going through the same chaos just because you were ignorant? And then that was a spark that basically fueled everything. And I said, you know what? This is not going to work. And initially, it was more the candidate experience. My problem was because the inhumanity really, really bothered me. But then when I had to recruit for my own startup, I had 2,000 resumes in front of me. And I remember looking at those resumes and being like, how do I understand who I should interview? Those tell me nothing about who a person is. It was in 2019, I had to create my first resume. And I remember looking at that one pager when it was done and I hated it. It was almost like, I'm going to destroy you. You're telling nothing about me to that employer. You're not telling the value that I can bring, how much of an asset that I can be. You're reducing me to these data points that don't actually translate to business outcomes, to actionable data. And you also don't know the contextual information about how I was able to like achieve those goals in the organizations that I've supported in. So I've always had a problem with resume ever since I created one. And I also had these experiences where I was constantly rejected, and ghosting is also like a must. So I found myself just holistically picturing what is actually going on in each of those steps and then actually living them and then seeing what would be a better way so that we can actually build the bridge that should have existed all along. And that's really my motivation. And I was lucky to meet my co-founder, who's the technical end of things. And I'm so lucky because he has been the co-founder that I always dreamed of, that I would have.
Yeah, great what you're saying there. Candidate experience sucks, doesn't it? I've never had a great candidate experience yet. I'm not saying never, but yet. Not the one that jumps out to me. But as you pointed out there, you know, in your own startup, you had 1,000, 2,000 applicants. It's hard to be specific and give great feedback to 2,000 people, whatever it is. And if we think about large organizations who are hiring at scale, big well-known brands, they just get inundated. So the first sift, that first gatekeeping is almost like an instant rejection. You're lucky if you get that within an hour, or you never get it at all. So how can we start thinking in a more candidate-centric way? Because studies have shown that often candidates are also clients and customers. So if we don't treat our candidates right, that can damage our brand, can't it?
Absolutely. I love how you put it. And there was a quote by a Forbes HR Council member who says that we have built our current recruitment tools to reject candidates and not to select them. And having been a recruiter, like today, for example, when I talk to recruiters and employers and asking if they're currently posting their jobs, they're telling me no. And particularly, they're not posting on LinkedIn. LinkedIn used to be an asset for those people, but now it's not, because they're telling me, you know, if I do, well, I'm just going to get spam applications and people who haven't read my job descriptions, don't meet the qualification, and I'm just going to be wasting my time there. When you're a recruiter, when you see an applicant tracking system, it's really true. Like, you're trying to get rid of the unqualified pipeline as fast as possible. And that means a lot of people are falling through the cracks. And again, like, the get rid doesn't mean that you're trying to sort of, you know, be inhumane in that process, but you're a recruiter. Like, imagine that you're going after or have two roles that you're hiring for. Let's say you're hiring for a software engineer and a product manager. And if you're getting 500 applications for each of them, what you're going to do, you're going to use filtering, keyword search, Boolean. That's what we were taught to do. That's how the systems work. But if I don't know how to format my resume, like, I have experienced this. And I've also seen this happening. Hiring managers look at a resume, format a resume, and they tell me, no, there is no way that I'm going to allow that candidate to be moved forward in the process. Resumes are not standardized. You know, like, without the standardization, how do you compare, like, apples to, you know, pears or apples to cherries? And essentially, that's what we're trying to do. The only thing that we should have been focusing on is actually the actionable data part, which resumes were supposed to focus on. But again, missing a lot of contextual information, behavioral information, and hundreds of more data points that I can hear count. So coming back to the employer brand, I mean, you go to a Glassdoor page and now candidates are talking about their interview experiences openly. If you've interviewed in a company, candidate is now become a YouTuber and they're going to be publicly speaking about the experiences that they just had. Your employers first, sorry, employers are advocates for you, but then the second advocates for your brand identity, your employer brand is candidates. And if you don't value those people, then they're going to talk about it. Let's say, you know, you're a McKinsey and you had this horrible experience with McKinsey as a candidate. That candidate is going to be talking to their closest circle. And now they are going to think twice when they're applying to McKinsey, no matter how good the brand is, because it really is based on trust. And if you don't build that trust effectively right in the beginning, if you don't value those candidates, then those candidates are not going to be applying to you. So you're going to be starting to miss out on the top talent in the market, and your competitors would get them just because they care, just because they're creating those right candidate experiences. And let me give you another data here. So the researchers looked at what really predicts retention and growth after those candidates are hired. And candidate experience is the core. And, you know, it's predicted by 90% of HR people that actually says candidate experience is a core predictor of retention and growth. And if you don't nail that, then how can you expect to retain those, you know, candidates that you hire as employees? Like, it's a way to build trust. It's a way to build that commitment to show this is how it's like when you're becoming an employee with us, when you're an employee with us. And if you're saying that this is how it looks like and we won't care about you when you're an employee, then how as a potential employee I can build a trust that you will train me with the right resources, that you will create the right environment for me to work in, that you will create growth opportunities for me, that I will be compensated fairly. You're shaking all of these foundations before they are even built if you don't have the right candidate experience. So that's essentially how it translates to you know, the negative influences on your employer brand.
You mentioned something in there, trust, and I'm a great advocate for trust has to be inherent in the process. We talk about psychological safety. There has to be psychological safety in the hiring process, in the candidate experience as well. The problem is, you said this when you were talking about your own application journey, all those thousands of CVs, thousands of applications you made. You got to the end in that process and you had zero faith or trust in the system, that almost like, why should I bother submitting another application? Because you had been so bruised and damaged by the past experience. You think, well, this is just pointless doing it. So your trust was at an all-time low that you were going to be given a fair hearing, treated fairly, whatever it was. So as recruiters, whether you're agency, RPO, or in-house, how could you reach out and bring that trust element back into the process?
That. So it really starts with the first experience. Like, in your careers page probably is the first place that the candidate is going to look at. Like, a day in life, how the culture looks like. And you shouldn't use like buzzwords. It's not about, for example, like leadership, but what that leadership means to you. For example, maybe you believe leadership should be shared, or how, you know, how do you empower those people in your organizations and real-time testimonials of them? Like, people hire people. That's something that we've forgotten in the process, and we have to bring this back. And starting from that careers page, everything on the website has to be optimized. You have to position yourself as, you know, answering why I should work for you, why I should work with you. What exciting mission are you working on that I should get excited about? And then when I scroll to the careers page, I should be able to see the growth opportunities that are waiting for me. And not only that, this is only done by so many few employers. For example, I think Johnson and Partners in the UK, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing their name correctly, but they're a retail brand. And they have been the most transparent organization that basically said, these are the stages that are waiting for you. These are the kind of questions that you will be asked. And in each step, this is the person you will be speaking to. And to succeed, these are the things that we will be looking out for. Now you're prepared. But many of the interviews don't prepare organizations and candidates for this. So candidates don't have the data. Like, you get an interview request. Why do you want to talk to me? Is this a first hiring manager interview? Is a recruiter going to be talking to me? Like, what am I asked to like answer? Am I asked to just, you know, participate in a live case study that I don't know nothing about? And then I find out on the spot, and then I'm asked to submit something in an hour. And I know that's just impossible. So candidates are set to fail almost. Like, you're setting your candidates to fail, which is so ironic. And then the job description, like, the job description is not only something that shows what the day-to-day looks like and what you expect from that candidate, from that potential employee to achieve, but also a way to position how it is like to work for you, like the mission that you're passionate about, the impact that you've created, how many organizations have you helped? You know, for example, for us, it's candidate experiences. It's the brands that we're able to help them humanize recruitment, our change makers, our partners. Show how that narrative looks like give them an insider perspective. You know, something that's really ironic, when I got those 2,000 resumes as a startup, as a recruiter for the first time in my first startup, we had an employer brand before the product itself, before an MVP. We were working from 5 different time zones. It was a mess, but the way that we positioned our vision resonated so deeply with people that they went on and apply. And that was not it. After they applied, I actually had a 20% like of the people filling out an 8-section form that I have prepared to be able to assess candidates. And that process looked entirely different from any of the interview processes that I've been to, because I couldn't find any of those answers in the resumes. Then more, you know, around 200 people actually went on and completed that. And one person gave me this feedback that it actually took them 4 hours to complete that form. And the reason is, it's not because it was that long, but it's because people were not used to being given that space, that opportunity. The 8-section form looked like, okay, like, I see that you're a current student or a mid-level like professional, but what do you want to do? Like, it was more reflective. How can I support you? What are the areas that you want to grow in? What are your skill sets? Like, you know, having people break down themselves as a SWOT, and it was a reflective opportunity for them that many of those, you know, people who worked with me were able to understand what kind of a career that they wanted to pursue. And I'm going to tell this as a recruiter, majority of the people, especially juniors and even middles, they don't know what they want. And it's your opportunity to help them reflect, to, you know, have a more coaching style of interview where they're able to understand this, because then you hire them and then they realize that job is not right for them. So help them understand. We treated those interview processes as transactional and as an interrogation, you know, sort of, you know, model, where the hierarchy is always, I, as a recruiter, have, you know, the upper hand until the candidate gets to the point of salary, and then things change. But it is a partnership. I, as a recruiter, am assessing a potential employee that I should be excited for the hiring manager that I'm supporting to, you know, to be working with. I am assessing that fit. And as a recruiter focusing on a strategy, the more you work with that hiring manager, if you're, for example, not, the more that you understand their expectations, the more you understand what kind of a, you know, leader, a mentor that person would be. So now you're hiring their report. Like, everything really is based on that human connection. And then we're trying to remove those human loops from the process and then automate them. So humans are not able to make the right hiring decisions. How can AI make the right hiring decisions if you remove human from the process? So long story short, it's really about creating that insider perspective. How is it like working for your employer, working for your organization? And as a recruiter, like, you know, how has your experience been like? All these things are very, very like simple and easy to do. Like, it takes a minute to add that something in, but it makes all the difference. And candidates really feel like there is a human behind the keyboard who will be, you know, assessing their application.
Going back to what you're saying there about you get the resume, the CV in, and you're trying to extract this data, and you're saying it's not geared up to actually give you the soul or the personality or the heart of that individual, which is what we really, ideally, we want to be hiring people, not paper, not numbers. I always think about the CV as very historical. It's a Wikipedia. It's not saying anything about you. We've kind of evolved the CV to be this master document of my life. This is what I've done. I'm a great believer in not how did you questions or what have you done questions. It's what would you do? How would you approach this? Or what's your thinking behind this scenario, which a CV doesn't show you? And which is why, you know, a lot more modern recruitment practices, anonymizing, they're using workplace samples, they're using 5 or 6 how would you questions, which actually require more effort from the candidate, because they can't just bombard you with their CV on auto. They have to actually look at these questions now. And that can actually filter candidates out because, oh, that's too difficult. But if you actually put the effort into crafting that great workplace sample, you know, how would you tackle this challenging situation? How would you tackle the data center's just gone down and you've got customers screaming at you? How would you handle that situation? What would you do first? That's we're getting into the mindset of the candidate, and then we can see what a valuable resource they would be in a crisis, in a team environment, what their personality is, isn't it? That's what we want to find out.
I love that. And that brings me to this like psychometric assessments that enterprises leverage really heavily. And then candidates feel insecure at that point because they're thinking there is a behavioral example that they're asking to answer. For example, you know, your colleague just stole something from the office. What would you do? And then there are like four different like answers to that. Like, do you protect your, colleague because they're your colleague and you like stand with them? Do you report that to the HR? Do you like ask them to, you know, return that? All of these things say something about your behavioral characteristics, your personality. But these tests are not, you know, leveraged in a way that creates psychological safety for a candidate because you're standing in front of that screen and you're thinking to yourself, what is the right answer? Like, because there are different right answers in that particular situation. Maybe the employer is trying to assess your loyalty there. Maybe they're looking for your like work ethics. If you're assessing loyalty, then you should ideally support your colleague who stole something from the organization. But from the business perspective, you shouldn't do that. But you don't know what they're assessing. So the psychological safety, I think, is really making things difficult for the candidate. Like, I understand that I'm being assessed right now, but what are you really looking to get from me? Like, what is it that you're really assessing? And I understand all these like cheating measures and sort of really trying to create an unbiased environment from a psychological experimenting perspective. And that's where we took these like studies from, essentially. All these psychometric assessment softwares that you see now, they were once psychological experiments. And essentially, we learned from that data. And now we basically productize them. But I think that candidates are not feeling safe with that. And it's not helping.
I think it's a bit like when you use ChatGPT or an AI system. You know, what you do at the beginning is you say, you are an expert this, and your role is to design that. It was like when you do the psychometric test, is you think, well, what am I applying for? I'm applying to be a programmer, a coder. Therefore, I'm going to put my head in that mode. If you're hiring me to be head of security or HR or audit, then I'll have a different answer because, you know, you want me to grass up your teammate. You want to be ultimately security focused, company focused. But if you're in a small team, you want this person to maybe talk to the person that's committed the wrongdoing and say, look, you really shouldn't have done that. I don't want to be the one that grasses you up. Why don't you go and hand it back or be honest yourself and coach them into that without colluding? So you want a different approach. So you just got to put your head in the mind of the job you're applying for. And people say you can't cheat these systems, but I think if you've got enough intelligence, you can move your brain into a space where you're thinking and acting in the model you have to act. So, yeah, I think what we're doing is we're almost forcing people to act. And we talk about bring your whole self to work. You don't actually want my whole self. You want this narrow bit that fits into your definition.
Yeah. Fully agree. And like recruiters are essentially like prone to look for red flags rather than, you know, the things that they like about the candidate that helps them move to the next stage.
It's down to risk though, isn't it? But the recruiter, if the recruiter's got two good candidates, it will come down to which one am I most comfortable, which one is least risk. And that is often a bias. You know, is that gut feel, is that spider sense? Oh, I just feel it. You know, you rub the paper, you go, this candidate just feels better to me for whatever reason. All those biases come out, don't they? So we have to recognize that personal bias has a huge influence on two identical candidates or even two candidates that are very close. I can't take the risk. If I hire this person, it goes wrong. People are going to blame me. People are self-protectionists as well. It's human nature.
Yeah. But I think that, again, like it comes back to what we evolve recruitment into. And that has become today, unfortunately, rejecting candidates. Because like if 500 people are applying, you have one opening. it's really, really, really difficult to get to that top 10 when you're able to like say, okay, now it's the top 5 and top 2. And then you also have to like have candidates, you have to, you know, keep them waiting on the sign because maybe someone will reject the offer. And now you have to be like thinking about your next move as a recruiter. But I think like recruitment has been evolved in a way that something that this candidate does is right and wrong, but I think that it should be focusing on the differences. Like, how would this candidate think about the situation? And maybe their way of thinking is particularly right for a company that is in a different stage than ours, and that's completely okay. If you think that is, then you know, you have to give them the feedback, and that would be really helpful to them so that they can go out and seek the right jobs for them. But going back to bias, you need data. There is nothing in the process that is removing those biases. Like, we have software today that removes, for example, like the names of the candidates and like the contact information. We had the DEI software that focused on reporting measures. So it was more like, do you want more females in your organization now? Or do you want more diversity? And diversity was diversity in a way that it was healthy, but it was more like, hey, this, you know, Mr. Government, this is the type of employees I hire now, you know, like give me more funds. And I don't think that that's the right way to go about diversity. Inclusion has to be, you know, for all the candidates that you're putting in the process for. And if, for example, I'm a neurodiverse candidate, I don't always do well in the interview. My brain works differently, and recruiter can say that my thoughts are unstructured. I don't know what I'm talking about. And for example, it is on you to like set those candidates for success, like send them the questions that you want to ask in advance. And then the candidate could then have the risk basically to, you know, read things from ChatGPT, and we have things that are happening. But the candidates are doing this because their trust is entirely gone in recruiters. Like, we're talking to people today and they're rather wanting to be assessed by an AI than a recruiter because those recruiters are making them go through like horrible candidate experiences. And I think that's a pledge that we all have to take. Like, you know what? I understand that things have been really hard, but to rebuild this trust, we have to work together. And I think that that's really how things can move forward, because I cannot be like, these people are adults when you look at it. Like, the anti-cheating measures and tracking software to me feels just utterly dystopian. And I personally don't want them in my hiring process, because if I don't trust my candidate and they know that I don't trust them, how can you empower them as employees to do what's right when push comes down to shove, when they need to take an incentive? Micromanagement doesn't lead to success. We all know this. And then the question all comes to like remote work and on-site and everything else. But I don't think that's the way to go. So we have to focus on rebuilding that trust, I think, to overcome those biases.
I used to do a lot of work with smart recruiters. I went to a lot of their conferences, spoke at a lot of their conferences, but pre-COVID. I got to know their founder, CEO Jerome, quite well. And he talks about these three dimensions of hiring success, as he would put it. So you've got the cost per hire, the hiring velocity, and the candidate experience. And they can't all be high. Sorry, you can't have it. You've got to balance those. If you want great candidate experience, you can't do it cheaply. If you want hiring velocity at a pace, you can't do it cheaply without sacrificing candidate experience. So you've got that three-legged stool. If you're not careful, what you end up doing is trading off for speed and velocity, because you've got empty seat costs. You've got need to fill that vacancy. Therefore, you're not going to think about diverse hiring best practice, because you've got to get somebody in that chair. You know, they've got a 3-month lead time once you've made the offer, and you want, so basically this is a 6-month hiring cycle, and you want someone now. So you can't do it cheap. You can't take your time, do it properly. Your candidate experience is going to be rubbish, because you're just firing people in, filling them up, and you're just going to pick what you've got. So how do you balance those things? And actually, which is the most important, candidate experience, cost per hire, or velocity? Which one do you sacrifice, or should you?
I think that it's not the question of a sacrifice, but I think these things are interconnected. Like, this is a system that you're talking about. And I think that if you nail candidate experience, then essentially you're reducing your costs for all things involved. And the reason is because you're attracting the right candidates for you. Because those candidates are essentially pre-qualifying themselves and they now know what kind of an organization that they will be working in. So you're really getting engaged candidates, which essentially makes you not repeat the hiring process over again and basically double your hiring costs. So when investing in your candidate experience, you're actually fixing all of them. In terms of the velocity, I think that really depends on what kind of a role that you're hiring for, but every role like should look different. What kind of a case study will you be like leveraging, for example, because you also need to focus on how to understand how the candidate thinks, but without, you know, basically making them do unpaid labor, which is a massive like concern in Canada today. So maybe you compensate those case studies that might be, you know, costly, but then you basically say, you know what, I'm going to send only to like the 10 candidates that I know who might be qualified for the position. I think that investing in candidate experience makes you attract the right candidates, and those right candidates are now engaged. So now you are able to move much faster because you're in attracting them to your inbound. So this means that you don't have to go out and seek those candidates on LinkedIn, message them, and outreach. It really takes so much time. And even recruiters get ghosted here. Like ghosting is not just for candidates at this point. Candidates also, as a response, can try to like ghost recruiters because of what is going on in the current job market. So I think that candidate experience ultimately reduces your costs. But if you like treat it right, if you don't understand how candidate experience is positioned within your greater hiring strategy, and how the hiring experience will look like, and how, you know, different stages will basically need different stakeholders to engage. For example, maybe a hiring manager did like sense to send the feedback, or a recruiter needs to collaborate with another recruiter. Maybe there's a decision making. So if you structure this, then essentially you will be able to move much faster in this process. But again, I think that candidate experience is not costly as people think. Writing that one line of, this is what our culture looks like in a day-to-day, you know, we, for example, like describe someone's day-to-day. Like I wake up, I get my coffee, I start my day in XYZ. Where are they working from? Maybe you are like giving like remote work opportunities. So share the real life experiences of a successful employee profile so that the candidate can see, well, I'm represented there or not represented there. So the people who actually read your job descriptions will be resonating with that. And essentially, they will be the ones who apply, and you will be reducing on all costs included. Like, you don't need to invest in a software to do this. So I really think that it's really about focusing on maintaining that human connection. And it is not as costly as you think. And you really don't need to invest in a specialist software, especially if you're a small organization.
What we're talking about here is the early stage of the sift. It's the talent attraction element, the employer brand, making sure that people resonate with you. It's do the data gathering. And then we're doing in the long list down to the short list of 10 candidates. We haven't actually met these people yet, have we, really, in most of these cases? And I'm a great believer. When I'm a candidate, I just want to meet you. Get me off of the paper. Get me off of the ATS into your face, because I know I can sell myself. I can smile. I can engage. I can adapt. I can be a chameleon around what you need face to face. But if I'm trying to argue on a bit of paper, that's not me. I can't. I'm not interested. I want the human connection. So how do we give candidates more face-to-face time without it being burdensome? Because as you say, you see horror stories of organizations that get people in for 10 interviews. They want you to do this presentation. They want you to do this work summary. They want you to write an application or design something for them. And you think, oh, God, blimey, I'm doing all this work. And then you get this feeling that they're actually using you as a prototype. If you're marketing, they want to see who's got the best marketing idea. And even if they don't hire you, they still pinch your idea. Yeah. So people are worried about their own intellectual property at this stage as well, aren't they?
I think the best thing that you can do is actually find out who you will be working with and then reach out to that person directly. But then, like, for example, as a recruiter, you will get a lot of messages. And I don't think that going to the recruiter will still like get you on the top of the pile. A recruiter won't remember each of the few thousand candidates who applied, but message the recruiter. Yes, they will go out and check with you. but they might not be able to assess your competency because you have to remember that a recruiter is not a specialist. So if I'm helping the, let's say, lead product manager hire an associate product manager, I have not been a product manager myself. And as much as I can talk to the like hiring manager, I still don't have the nuances of what they're seeking. So go directly to the hiring manager saying, hey, I've applied. I'm really excited because your mission really resonates with me, or the product that you're working really relates to my experiences or the areas that I want to grow. Here are some of the things that I've achieved. And I would be like really grateful for a response, or, you know, basically directly going to that person who you will be meeting with if you're involved. And if they like it, then you basically will get an interview and hiring manager will be the one to prompt it. In the current process, unfortunately, this is the shortest cut, the shortest pathway. This is not ideal, absolutely not ideal, especially if all of those 1,000 candidates in the pipeline end up doing this. So you really have to like mindful about the message that you're writing. And if you should give them actionable data. Like as a candidate, you have to remember that the employer is looking for actionable data. What makes you the right fit for that position? And, you know, how do you become that successful employee profile? I think that's really important. And don't be like forceful in your messages. Like that's not going to leave a good impression. Or don't tell the recruiter, hey, you haven't like checked my response in like 2 weeks. The recruiter is probably drowning in applications. No recruiter wants to leave the messages unanswered or leave the applications unanswered. But sometimes they're stuck because the hiring manager says, you know what, I need a week because I have XYZ to finish in my current operations. So the hiring process extends for another week and then another week. The recruiter is really the frontline person here who doesn't have much control in, you know, the internal operations, but she is the one or he is the one that is representing whatever that is going on and maintaining those communication processes with you.
But we know that in big organizations, suddenly that role goes on hold. You know, the project gets canceled, or there's another thing going on in the organization, a merger or a diversification. So the recruiter sat there in the middle of this recruitment project and suddenly she's got no idea what's going on around them. So, yeah, as a candidate, you're obviously thinking, well, they must be ready to hire, but that's not always the case. And some of them, sometimes they're speculative, go to market to see who's out there as well, aren't they? So they're not all, I know it's a bit unethical to do speculative job seekers and just to get people in, but it does happen. People are testing the market. They want to know, if we were to open an office in this new city, what's our likely response rate? So you might want to put stuff out there, you know, fly a kite, as they say, just to see what the interest is.
Absolutely. I think that one unethical practice that I really hope we can like put an end to, and LinkedIn has been taking some action against this, but it's really, really hard to know, especially when you're a validated employer, ghost posting, like the jobs that are not actually real. And the main intention of that is actually increasing the amount of LinkedIn followers, because if you do not opt out, then essentially, as a candidate, you follow the employer, and then that basically increases their follower count. So the marketing team sees this as a shortcut. I'm really sorry, but this is what's going on. So you have to understand whether that job is real, and it's really hard to do.
Now, we've got to remember that recruitment is sales and marketing. It's like buying or selling a house. It's like anything. You're just trying to match needs and resources. And yeah, it's, some people are ethical, some people aren't ethical, or some people bend the ethics to suit their own definition. So people will use any sales technique. And you've got to remember that whilst you're the most important person to you, you're not the most important person to the recruiter. The recruiter's boss is there, who they're trying to hire for, is their client, really. You are just the plate of chips in McDonald's. You're just the food at the end of the day, and the recruiter decides whether you want chips or whether you want jacket potato. And it's trying to get into that mindset that you're not special. You're just one of a whole pile of people.
I think that's where it is, but I think that's where we went wrong. Like again, the transactionalism, it must come to an end. If you're being hired by a recruitment agency, if you're a candidate and a recruitment agency recruiter has seeked you out, the process will look like entirely different and the candidate experience will be relatively better because you, I don't know how to put it like this way, you said the food, so I'm just going to use that, but essentially you are valuable because if you get hired, then they get a bounty of that or a commission of that. So they need you to get hired. But again, like if they think that you're the right fit, then you're going to be seeing the top candidate experience possible from that recruiter. But I really think that, again, like we have to reestablish recruitment as a partnership. Like it's not just me who is getting hired, but I'm also hiring you as an employer. Like I'm basically saying, I have all of these great skills, great qualifications. And if you work with me, these are the things your organization is going to be achieving. And these are the areas that I can grow myself in. And it's really about meeting in the middle. Like, it's not, you know, one gets the upper hand and the other like fights against it. And I think that that mentality led us here, really. Like, we have to focus on rebuilding the bridge and we have to understand and reestablish recruitment as a partnership.
So you touched on AI earlier. I'm reading these posts on LinkedIn and other forums around recruitment. And what we're ending up in is an AI bot talking to an AI bot. You know, we look at all these no-code platforms, Zapier, Pabbly, AN, Mate.com, all these sort of things. You can build all this stuff that will scrape job listings, take the requirements, take your persona and merge it and produce that and then email the recruiter off. And the recruiter's got this ATS that sucks all that in. AI pre-processes it, matches against the job spec. And then if you're good enough, you do. So are we going to be in a market where in the old days it was, if I pay $150, I can get someone to write my CV for me that will be ATS friendly, keyword, Boolean. They'll redo my LinkedIn profile so I'll stand more chance. Now you're going to have AI, no code people writing automation scripts to say, right, you pay me $1,000 and I'll get you in there and I'll target you and I'll guarantee you'll be submitted to, I don't know, 50 a day and it will be individually tailored. And then we'll just end up in a world where it's like super catfishing, isn't it, on dating sites where you just, when you finally meet each other, you're going, oh, who are you? Exactly. That's where we're going to end up, isn't it?
I love how you put it. One recruiter said to us, like, it's almost like in among those 500 candidates, I'm looking for a simple human being because, like, ChatGPT, like, it's almost a new form of language where everyone just, like, knows it as they see it. Like, they call it out. As a recruiter, I know, like, instantly when a cover letter is generated by GPT, like, and I'm not against GPT being used, like, in that process. Of course, like, use it. Of course, paraphrase it. But if you're not putting any additional effort, then, like, how do I know as a potential employee you will be putting that effort? So, like, if I'm not looking to hire someone, like, average, I'm looking for someone exceptional in that process. And you're essentially telling me that you're not the exceptional person that I'm looking to hire. So you're essentially wasting your own time. And going back to your question, so there is a data just before, like, even these automation tools came in for candidates, 70% of candidates today already, like, lied or exaggerated facts in their resumes. We know this. So who you end up hiring or they're sort of, you know, moving in the processes.
But 70% of organizations and companies lie about the job as well. So it's two people bullshitting each other, oh, yeah, isn't it? We're both selling. That's what we're doing. We're both selling an opportunity.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, you know, going back to it, it's really now hard because we know that AI hallucinates. Like, I've tried these tools myself as well. Like, it tells the, you know, the AI tool that I'm able to speak like Dutch, French, and German and applies to all these positions that I'm not qualified for. And then I see the LLM as written, you know, the paragraphs. And then, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. And the recruiters are, you know, seeing them and being like, no, absolutely not. AI is not necessarily processing the applications today, which is really the hardest part because like governments have serious consequences, you know, against it. They're basically telling you AI cannot make employment decisions. Like there is a critical, you know, laws around this where you you have to see each of the resumes that are being passed on, and filtering out is one way. And AI is able to currently like summarize or pull like information of those resumes and score them, but it cannot and should not make hiring decisions because you still require that human judgment in the process. But again, like the employers, again, that's why we have to focus on building that bridge. Like, how do we meet in the middle and stop, BSing each other in this game?
So if we start talking right at the very beginning about trying to see me as a human being in this process, and one thing I've always wanted to happen is you apply for an organization and they said, actually, now we've met you, we think you might be better for this role or this role or this role. Can we talk to you about other things we do in our organization? So hiring into a talent pool, if you like, or fishing people into this talent pool where they start to evaluate you, where they have a whole smorgasbord, to use a Finnish word, of opportunities here. We want to see where you fit in the organization, because actually we want to hire you because you're a great asset to our company. And then once you're here, we'll figure out what to do with you. And I say, look, give me a job and then figure out what to do with me, because I'll evolve into it as well. And if you think about quite the best organizations, there's job share opportunities, there's career pivoting, there's moving into different areas of the business. Why can't I do that on the way in rather than have to wait till I'm there to do that?
It's a great question. Personally, my opinion is that those talent pools do not work. Like, the initial reason that, those recruiters or employers in general are building those pipelines is because so that they can have access, and it's actually reduced candidate acquisition cost, because then they have to do recruitment marketing. And then that means another investment to their recruitment budget. But most of those candidates never even get contacted. And then, it just becomes a reporting metric again. I think that what you're saying makes a lot of sense. There is one person, Constanti, who's been working on this for the last 20 years. And he says that you essentially, hire someone and they become the perfect employee. Like, you cannot expect for a candidate to, fill all the boxes before you hire them, because you train them and they evolve into the job, as you mentioned. But we don't have any tools today that focus on that evolution, that growth potential. And that's exactly one of the gaps that we want to fill in with Octopus. And essentially, like, you don't have the data as a recruiter to show, hey, Joanne is going to be growing to these areas, or this person is inclined to grow in XYZ directions, and they can therefore like create value for your business. It's really hard to assess that, especially when you have so limited data that is not actionable.
But what a lot of progressive companies, I'd argue they're progressive, is they're building their own academies. So they're, whether you want to call it later life apprenticeships, whatever you want to call it, recognizing that you don't always make the right decision when you go to college, when you go to university. Mm-hmm. When you're 25, you think, I don't want to be a chef. I want to be an engineer. Mm-hmm. And all of those early career opportunities suddenly disappear. Whereas some of the smarter companies are looking and saying, okay, if you're a returning parent in your 40s, whether you've been very redundant in your 50s, whether you're wherever you are in your life, we're looking for fantastic people in our organization. And in the same way, if you wanted to train to be a doctor, you go into a hospital and you do rotation around all the different departments. And think, actually, I want to be a brain surgeon. Or no, I want to be in geriatrics. I want to be in this. I want to be in that. So you specialize once you've done your baseline qualification. So if organizations were looking at building talent academies, which is more active than a passive talent pool. I'm not talking about a marketing database. I'm talking about active opportunities to get people in who are seen as great assets to the organization, and then we'll build you and nurture you into positions. And we maybe discover in the first 3 months, actually, you can go this way instead. That gives people an opportunity to get back into the job market from the depression that you felt into working with an organization. You're going to be loyal. I mean, just think about the investment they're giving you and the investment you want to give back, that loyalty you're going to give, because there's trust there, isn't there?
That's true, but that also takes a lot of investment. Like, a number of enterprises today would be able to invest in such a large, because when you look at the L&D power behind it and all those people who have to like if they're able to build those, you know, specific targeted academies, it means that they have figured out their own kind of like the role structures, like their L1s to L5. How does L5 look like for me versus how does it look like for you? But then you're a seed stage startup and you're like, okay, you have to wear so many hats and you cannot necessarily focus on that transition. So I think that if an expectation from the candidate is towards more structure and towards that flexibility, you know, you might enjoy wearing the hats, but maybe you will realize that you want to do something more specific. So you have the more freedom and also safety in enterprises, I would say. And that's why it's really important to like assess the behavioral characteristics of a person. One thing that I really focus on in my interviews, for example, do you feel more comfortable in structured environments, structured tasks where like you don't have to deal with abstract instructions and you essentially are doing something with you know, like assigned training, manual, and now there is not much uncertainty there. But there are also some people who love that uncertainty. For example, me, like give me the biggest, most complex problem and I'd rather solve that on my own than, you know, go from point A to B repetitively. But for some people, they want to specialize from like going on A to B, for example, let's say creating marketing campaigns in that specific area. Maybe they want to specialize on Google Ads. So it's really is, you know, we're different as individual differences. And I think that in terms of that flexibility, not every organization will be able to provide that. And it's important for candidates to also recognize that as they're applying, because if that's an expectation and you're applying to a startup who recently got funded and they're in a seed and even like Series A round, they won't be able to provide the same flexibility. But if you, for example, go to a more mature environment, let's say a startup who's raised their like Series C, Series D, Series E, then you're really talking about that enterprise structure where you're able to see how those roles and expectations have evolved, how other people perform, because like all that academies are built on the previous experiences. What did I learn internally that I can translate to, you know, external resources to attract the right talent for me? But if I lack that learning, then I essentially can't build the right funnels that I will be able to attract the right ICP, the ideal candidate persona, who will then transform into my successful employee persona.
Hmm. Yeah, it's not easy, is it? It's not easy. And you say, you know, do I want structure? I love living in a world with chaos. It allows me to create, allows me to ideate, allows me to spitball, blue sky think, whatever it is. But that's all well and good until you actually want me to deliver something for you. Because my chaos is going to be different to your chaos. My expectations, your expectations are going to be different. So the moment I have to deliver something, my first question is, let's nail it down. I don't want chaos at this point. I want certainty. Because if I'm going to have to work something and deliver you something, I want certainty. And I think it depends on the role, doesn't it? You know, if you're looking for an R&D with unlimited budget, what we're going to do is sit there and drink coffee and ideate, or whether you actually want a project team that's going to come up with something. You know, you have your agile phase, you have your bit of ideation. I think the candidates you're going to get, kind of, you want them to be able to swap between those contexts, don't you, as well? So you can't always find that out from a bit of paper in the interview. Do you like structure or do you like chaos? As you say, my answer would be, I like both. But it depends on what you want at the time you want it. The recruitment process we have, it's not fit for purpose, is it? We're still reliant on the CV. I often train organizations around modern, contemporary recruitment practices, which is, it's not just anonymizing the CV, it's just don't have one. And using workplace samples, using the 5 questions, 400 words each, then grading them against predefined metrics and follow that process all the way through to interview and each level. And having a diversity of thought on those questions and answers as well. But I still come back when I'm in boardrooms talking to people and they say, well, how do I know who they are without their CV? Well, you don't. You have to trust. You have to trust the process. What if we hire someone and I find out something later because I haven't got the CV? Yeah. You have to trust the process. But people are so wedded to this document that we created in the 80s with fax machines. Before then, we used to fill them in by hand, didn't we? We used to fill application forms in. And then the fax machine arrived and we started printing stuff out and faxing it to each other.
Yeah, the first ever example, like that is considered the first resume, was actually created by Da Vinci. So that old we were speaking about, and he was wanting to work in an architectural project. So he had to like summarize what he has done. And that's the first experience. And it comes from like resume to summarize. So essentially you're re-summarizing the things that you've done in a more digestible manner. So that was the earliest example. And I think that like resumes worked until some point, because I think that we were still focusing on that, you know, the human element of it. But then with tech, we couldn't figure out how to marry that technology with our emotional intelligence. And I think that's the challenge that we're facing today. Like, we have to be efficient, yes, but at the cost of that, you know, human touch, we became efficient. So looking at the history of resume, when from your point, you used to mail those resumes into organizations, and then you would never hear back if you were rejected, because how can I send 500 replies? And like, mail was expensive. How can I, you know, like send that back to your address? So I only reach out to people who I'm interested in and would like to speak to. You naturalize that process then, but then come, you know, digitization, like the HTML job application portals, the first applicant tracking system, digitizing that entire process. The hiring decisions today are still not made on those applicant tracking systems, which is the most like biggest irony to me, because you know, applicant tracking systems cost thousands and thousands of dollars, up to 100,000 or more, even like for enterprise level organizations and the biggest software providers. And they're saying that they streamline your recruitment. But if you're not making hiring decisions, or if you're not enabled to make those hiring decisions, then what do you streamline exactly? Like, if that software is not giving that actionable data to you, what do they streamline exactly? And what I see is then, you know, because they don't have that actionable data, these tools have empowered us to even build more layers on top of it. So it's like now not three processes, not three steps of interviews, but like seven stages where there are case studies involved, system design interviews, all these different interview processes that I am assessing you. And then you're being asked to like resubmit a case study, re-interview, just because they cannot collect the actionable data. And that's where we have to focus on. And again, like,
or the recruiter's risk averse, and they just want to be really, really sure, really, really, really sure. They're almost scared to make a decision sometimes, which is why they want to see you again. It's like, oh, I can't decide. Let's get them back in for another chat. And yeah, I think some of it is just lack of decision making or structured process.
I would say structured process, yes, but without that actionable data, you're not able to like move anyone forward. You should be able to say, I'm moving John Doe because he was able to demonstrate their XYZ qualifications and meets my qualifications because, you know, like they want to grow in XYZ areas. Like, you should be able to, you know, picture that and position that completely if you're moving that candidate in the process. But I wouldn't say it's a risk aversion, and you would do this as a recruiter as well, because it costs up to more than the annual salary of an employee if they mishire. So then it even might cost them their job, depending on the policy of the organization, or it just, you know, leads to drastic consequences.
Well, that's risk aversion, isn't it? That's risk aversion. You know, we know that the average 30K salary costs 130K in on costs of getting it wrong. Yeah. So there is a risk aversion there, and that people are driven by, I can't mess this up. You know, if this person, A, is not right for us, or we're not right for them, because that happens as well. You know, you get the rejection on offer, you get the first 14 days, we think, oh, this isn't for me, I'm out, that walkout. So yeah, it is a risk. And I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to minimize those risks on both sides, protect ourselves, protect my own job. And I think some of it is just down to lack of vigor and data in the application process. We should be able to say, that person was good enough. That will do. Stop. Don't need to look any further. Rather than saying, oh, no, we need to see the next 200 people. I say, well, no, if you've seen the right person after three, stop. Nothing wrong with that. Sorry. We've hired.
I think that, like, the recruiter has to be constantly moving along and constantly making sure that there's like a backup of that candidate, and then expectations are not being communicated well. And I think that that's really creating a disconnect. But one more thing about the actionable data side, going back to like establishing recruitment as a partnership, I don't know why you're inviting me to a first interview. So what we're doing with Octopus is, hey, recruiter, this is a real-time data that we collected because you've sent this targeted smart pre-interview. You have those answers before even meeting that candidate. If they're not the right fit, you won't invest 20 hours for that candidate because they're not qualified for your role. Hey, dear candidate, if you're not the right fit and looking at this, you're not feeling happy, we're saving you 20 hours because that's on average the roles expect you to like invest in per role in today's job market. If you were to pursue 5 jobs at the same time, that makes 100 hours and that leads you to burnout if you're, you know, pursuing all of them at the same week. It's more than double full-time job expectations, but that's how long it really takes today. So it's really a process that burns out both of the sides. So looking at the partnership again, hey, recruiter, this is the data that we collected. Hey, candidate, this is how you were able to demonstrate your skills and qualifications. Here's how you meet like the expectations. When you're going to that interview, you should know what you've done well, what you have not done well. And now you know how to position yourself. And because you completed that pre-interview, you now know what kind of questions that the recruiter is going to ask you. So now you're set to succeed, not set to fail. And that's basically what we want to do. Like, then we can really talk about an actionable structured interview where you're not starting from point zero. Hey, who are you? And where do you see yourself in 5 years? Like those kinds of unstructured interviews that don't lead us to anywhere. Like if you're assessing the creativity of the candidate, go ahead. But maybe in 5 years, we're going to be dealing with another pandemic. And that just doesn't tell me what I can achieve in your organization in the long and short term. So focus on the competency instead, the job performance. Many of the interviews today are structured to assess interview performance and expect that to be translated to job performance, which is, again, a massive problem. But going back to, you know, that partnership, if both sides have the same data now, then we can really finally talking about them being on the same page and Octopus having built that bridge. And that's why I care about that work so much, because in every feedback, the candidate will get better in every interview and every feedback that they got from Octopus, who is being the bridge in between them. And the recruiters also will figure out how to better collect that actionable data. So we're not replacing recruiters, and AI cannot and should not and will not. Like, it's a human hiring human being. So I would say that's really the core thing that we have to focus on as we focus on, you know, building that bridge and building that intersection between the human touch, the emotional intelligence and technology, I think.
So, see, it's been absolutely fascinating. We could chat all day, I'm sure. So you mentioned Octopus several times. So you're the founder and CEO of Octopus. Do you want to just give us, in a nutshell, your elevator pitch? What is Octopus?
Absolutely. I've just been talking about that. I should have waited for that question. But to give you in a nutshell, Octopus, if you're an organization, helps you move forward only the candidates that are aligned with your qualifications into your pipeline. So you don't have to go through the 500 resumes that don't meet your qualifications and instead send a smart pre-interview that is created based on your job description. And from there, you will be able to assess the qualifications you're looking for automatically. Candidates are going to be submitting their answers to that. So it's like a text-based interview. And on that, they will be positioning themselves and you will have given the space for them to really show what they can do for your organization and the additional information that they like to mention. And then you will be able to access that data real time. And all those qualifications will be scored based on your requirements. So everything that you've given us, it's about you. You take that ownership, that flexibility, and it's different for every job, every role, every company. And that's why we created Octopus, you know, as to be your extra tentacle in this process. Because as we say that, the problem is so big and massive right now that arms are not solving it. So we developed tentacles. That's our motto. So we're here to be your extra tentacle and help you make that right hiring decision and essentially build the bridge between the right candidate and you. And the every candidate who submits that pre-interview with you gets a feedback from Octopus saying that this is how they were able to align with your requirements and demonstrate themselves effectively. So in every pre-interview that you're sending, you're actually nurturing your talent pool, and those candidates will remember because you've given them feedback. No recruiter today gives candidates automatically the actionable feedback that they're looking for. 90% of them go. So if you're looking for to become a top employer, then we'd love to be your extra tentacle.
Fabulous. What a punchline. Let us be your extra tentacle. And we know that octopuses or octopi, they're seriously intelligent creatures, aren't they? They're smart beyond their means. They're almost like an alien life form because they're so intelligent. Yeah, I think so. The extra tentacle and with intelligence as well, no doubt.
Absolutely.
So see, it's been fascinating. And if people get hold of you, how can they get hold of an octopus demo or find out more?
Absolutely. You can reach out to us on our website, which is joinocto.co. So that would be joinco.co. Or you can find me on my LinkedIn, which is Seekuz. So in any case, I'd love to hear from you. And if you're being challenged with your current hiring process and overwhelmed by so many tools today, I'd also love to help you, find the right direction. Our goal with Octopus is to, help you and give you ownership that you must and should have as we navigate the age of AI, human should.
Fabulous. And just if you're listening, Seekuz, that's C. You've abbreviated your name because it's Turkish and it's easier for people to say C. So C, full stop. And then Guz is G-U-Z. So if you're looking for you on LinkedIn, C.Guz. Okay. Easy to find you.
Thank you.
Absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. Today's discussion struck a chord. Consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.